Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the battle between diplomacy and war, with President Obama and 7 Republican senators who support diplomacy on one side and 47 Republican senators on the other side who offer no alternative but war with Iran. Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, The Magnificent Seven, and why he still belongs to the party of Lincoln and Eisenhower, even though the Tea Partier Tom Cotton appears to be the tail that is wagging the dog, that is the new Republican majority in the Senate, which appears to be a captive of bitter vitriol and racist bile. And then we'll go to Ferguson, Missouri, and speak with Doug Moore, a diversity reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, about the shooting of 2 police officers during last night's protest in front of the troubled Ferguson police station, which began shortly after Ferguson's police chief resigned after being singled out in a scathing Justice Department report alleging racial bias in his police department and in the local court. We will discuss the angry response from Attorney General Holder, who described the shooter as, quote, a damn punk trying to sow discord in an area that was trying to get its act together, trying to bring together a community that had been fractured for too long. Then finally, we'll discuss the urban, racial, and demographic trends behind the patchwork of small municipalities around St. Louis, Missouri, where local governments rely on traffic tickets for revenues, and where courts have a revolving door of judges and prosecutors, and local governments in majority-minority communities are often dominated by whites. Todd Swanstrom, a professor of community collaboration and public policy at the University of Missouri, joins us to discuss the democratic awakening underway in Ferguson. And joining us now is Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. And currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Magnificent Seven. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And in terms of your sort of lament about the state of your party, the Republican Party, it does seem, though, that Tom Cotton is the tail that wags the dog. He's a freshman, and he is a self-proclaimed Tea Partier. And it's extraordinary that everybody went along with him, at least 46 other senators. Were they afraid of just – are the Republicans afraid of the Tea Party? Is that what it comes down to?
Ian, I think that's part of it, but I think there's a bigger part of it that is just simply expressed as opposition to this president. Whatever this president wants to do, they don't want to do. And there's a significant majority of my party, and this 47 sort of reflects that – simply acts on that principle. Whatever the president wants to do, they do not want to do, and they muster everything in their power, and of course they have a majority in both houses now, to bring that about. We had an expression in the George W. Bush administration. It was called ABC, an acronym. It meant anything but Clinton, and it sort of expressed how Republicans of that ilk, neoconservatives in particular, despised Bill Clinton. They didn't despise him necessarily for his policies. They despised him personally. And I think that's become the way these Republicans look at Barack Obama.
Well, Tom Cotton was elected with the help of the Koch brothers. His political advisor is Bill Kristol, a hedge fund manager. Also, Peter Singer gave him money, Paul Singer, I should say. And his campaign was, you know, almost overtly racist. They didn't ever show a picture of Pryor, the incumbent who he defeated, the senator. They only showed pictures of Obama, and they did the same thing with Mary Landrieu down in Louisiana in the special election. Only showed pictures of the black man, and I get the impression that since Obama's been president, there has been a peculiar kind of galvanization of hatred around him that as you pointed out, is similar to the personal hatred that was directed towards Bill Clinton, but much, much more poisonous.
Absolutely more poisonous, and I go back to my previous comments on public television about my party having a number of racists in it. You go back to the days when Dick Nixon and his strategist essentially stole the Democrats, the hard South, the hardcore Democrats, and I knew them well because I was born in South Carolina. My surrounding family had many of them in it, away from the Democratic Party. He stole them away because they didn't like busing, they didn't like desegregation, they didn't like the black man and woman becoming their equals. And so they floated into, by huge margins, the Republican Party. And they're still there. And not only are they still there, they've migrated into places in Pennsylvania and Ohio, out west and so forth. And they are pure and simple racist. And anyone who maintains that there isn't a significant part of the Republican Party's distaste for Barack Obama that comes from that element is simply stupid.
And again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. He currently teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University and has an article at the Huffington Post, The Magnificent Seven. In your article, Colonel Wilkerson, you talk about this poisonous and vitriolic period being similar to the political climate in the early 1800s under President Thomas Jefferson. And of course, you had England and France sort of hovering around the young republic like sort of vultures. And in many ways, it also seems to me that the other period where the U.S., you know, barely survived was also very significant in terms of outside players, and that was the Civil War, where the British, of course, supported the South. And many British aristocrats predicted that the troubled American republics would finally find their way back to the monarchy. But on the other side, supporting the Union throughout the world, I was just reading this extraordinary quote from, of all people, Karl Marx, who supported the Union, proclaiming America's war was, quote, the first grand war of contemporaneous history in which the highest form of popular self-government till now realized is giving battle to the meanest and most shameless form of man's enslaving recorded in the annals of history. So, is this still there? Is that DNA still around there in terms of the unresolved civil war?
I think it is. We had a civil war that we know now from really good forensic research probably killed a million of our citizens for decades, for generations. We thought it was around 600,000, 700,000. We know now that casualties were probably in excess of a million. And if you look at the population at that time, that was a huge conflict, registering right there per capita-wise with things like World War One and the Iraq-Iran War, a bloody, brutal conflict, brother fighting brother, sister fighting sister, family fighting family. But then we had 100 years of slavery post-Civil War that was, in many respects, every bit as bad as what the Civil War was fought to get rid of. Economic slavery, financial slavery, you name it, Jim Crow, whatever you want to call it, permeated the experience of most blacks in this country. Look at what you just talked about as your second issue on the show today, on your radio show today, Ferguson, and you will see perfect evidence that it is still with us and still violent and still deadly and dangerous. This is not solved even yet. I don't want to belabor that point because we're talking about, you know, the situation with Iran and the situation with the 47 versus the 7. And let me hasten to say that I didn't mean to draw these people out, Corker and Lamar Alexander and the other 7 senators who stood up and didn't sign onto that idiotic letter that Cotton wrote, apparently, with Bill Kristol's help, probably. I didn't single them out as heroes so much as I did as people who at least still maintain some ability to be pragmatic, some ability to sense the nation's interest, some ability to work within the constitutional fabric that our founders gave us. To say that 47 of them, including people who were supposed to be stalwarts of my party, like John McCain and Lindsey Graham and so forth, I mean, Ted Cruz, he's an idiot. No one pays much attention to him except the choir to which he sings. But these other people who signed up to this stupid letter by Cotton indicate to me that my party's falling apart, that it doesn't have a grasp on reality. So I talked about the seven and singled them out simply to say that, my God, at least there are seven Republicans who understand what good governance is all about.
So, Colonel Wilkerson, is this, though, a product of a kind of growing anti-intellectualism, anti-science, throughout the country itself? There really is difficult to find a kind of consensus on what is real anymore. People do what they call reality shopping. Christians get their news from right-wing Christian television, liberals from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox. And it seems to me that John McCain opened the door to a kind of anti-intellectualism at the highest levels in our politics by appointing Sarah Palin as his vice president. And that seems to me to have given permission to people that are just sort of neophytes and ignoramuses to have equal time in the political discourse. Not that you're asking for elitism, but at least you have had a tradition in this country of people voting for people who they thought were better than them, not the same as them or dumber than them.
Well, you're talking about what Jefferson and Adams wrote about in their exchange after they resumed it when Jefferson had left the White House, in terms of its. And I think Jefferson and Adams both agreed that if you have an aristocracy in America, it is the aristocracy of the competent. And you do want to reach into that aristocracy of the competent, the educated, the elite, if you will, in order to govern you. The one thing that Adams and Jefferson could agree on when they did talk politics was finally, I think, that. Jefferson even admitted it in a very famous letter back to Adams. But if you want to look at what we've got now, I think it's like you said, and like the cover of the current issue of National Geographic illustrates, we have some 50% of Americans don't even believe in science anymore. You have museums in Kentucky that show Adam and Eve with dinosaurs. You have people who take you back to the Scopes trial in the 20s. This is crazy. You have over 150 million Americans, apparently, who don't believe in science, don't believe things that science is more or less, whether they're theories or not, corroborated. But you have people like Ted Cruz who went to Princeton and people like Tom Cotton who understand went to Harvard. These people are not stupid. I don't think they're stupid. I think what they're doing is even more insidious than perhaps we're suggesting. They are exploiting this vast pool of ignorance and apathy in America in order to hold on to power, indeed to gain power. Cotton and Crystal and Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers and others who might fund him want to put him in a position to be president of the United States. This is worse than being stupid and ignorant and dumb. This is being relatively smart and looking at the fabric of America and Americans who collectively, in at least a majority, a small majority, are apathetic and dumb, and exploiting that apathy and that ignorance in order to gain personal power for yourself. This is an aristocracy that doesn't take power, doesn't govern in order to take the nation to a better place. It is an aristocracy that governs in order to enhance its own personal power and wealth. That's very dangerous. That's the end of the republic.
And it would seem that one of the extraordinary things about these exercises in right-wing demagoguery and ideologically driven exercises of foreign policy, like this letter that you referred to as being stupid, and also the recent cave-in by the White House to Senator Marco Rubio and the anti-Castro Cuban lobby in his declaring that Venezuela is a threat to U.S. national security, which, of course, is ridiculous hyperbole. But again, it's done at the behest of that minority lobby. And all it's going to do is give the government of Venezuela the very excuse that it needs, which is they're blaming their troubles on the Americans. So, yeah, in this case, this letter is probably going to drive the Iranians closer to making a deal than driving them away from making a deal, which I'm not suggesting is a good idea, but I'm just saying these people, in order to exercise their right-wing ideology, they invariably shoot themselves in the foot.
They do, and I'm waiting for them to shoot themselves in a little higher location.
So where's the learning curve here? Is there one?
I'm not sure there is. Back to your point about Venezuela, if there's any threat to anybody, it's our threat to the Venezuelan government that bothers me. All you have to do for comment on the Obama administration and Secretary Clinton, for that matter, is to look back at how we dealt with the Honduran coup d'etat, supporting essentially people who would come back into the Honduran government and work with AT&T and others in this country and keep corporate contracts alive and so forth rather than democracy in Honduras. That's how we have treated Latin America for the past 100 years. Nothing's changed. It's not the Venezuelans that we should be aiming at. It's not, for that matter, any Latin Americans that we should be aiming at. It's ourselves. In the Western Hemisphere, we are the isolated party. The one thing the president has done to relieve some of that isolation is apparently, I hope, on 17 December, his announcement that we might have closer relations with Cuba and we might work towards even normal relations, lift the embargo, take them off the state sponsor of terrorism list, which they haven't belonged on for at least 20 years or longer, and maybe more. This is a positive move, but it's offset by the moves with respect to Honduras and Venezuela. We need to stop being the person, the country, the entity whom everyone hates in Latin America, and become the country that helps others in Latin America, the way John F. Kennedy expressed it when he put together his Alliance for Peace. We put the rhetoric out there, but we rarely, if ever, live up to that rhetoric.
Well, just in closing, turning back to Iran and this letter by the 47 senators to try and scuttle the deal, it may not succeed in doing so, but prior to that, of course, you had Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel being given the forum of the U.S. Congress in there, sitting in the front row, of course, with Sheldon Adelson. It was difficult to know whether the Republicans jumping to their feet in applause were applauding Adelson, their big donor, or Netanyahu. But even though Adelson's bought a whole newspaper dedicated to Netanyahu, there's a good chance that Netanyahu will lose.
And trying to buy another one.
Right. But there's a good chance that Netanyahu will lose.
And I got my fingers crossed and my prayers going to heaven that he does.
Well, it does seem like that might be one of a rare moment of a possible political change. And it certainly would isolate these 47 senators, wouldn't it?
It would, and I think that what you've just suggested, that their actions and actions like theirs by others in the Republican Party and some Democrats too have led not to their success but to Netanyahu's possible loss and probably an agreement with Iran. I will add, though, and this is important for Americans to understand, I watched the agreed framework negotiated basically by Bill Clinton's administration with North Korea. I watch it go into effect, and then as I came into the government in 2001, I watched how the United States Congress undermined that agreement. It undermined it by failing to fund the agreement itself, basically in two parameters, the heavy fuel oil shipments that were promised to North Korea and the funding of the light water reactors under the Korean Energy Development Organization, which the Europeans funded. We didn't come across with our funding, we didn't come across with the heavy fuel oil on time or in the amounts necessary, and so Congress undermined that agreement. And there was no surprise in October 2002 when we learned, both through our intelligence agencies and also through Jim Kelly going to Pyongyang and talking to Kang Suk-ju, that they had developed an alternative program, an enrichment, a uranium enrichment program. I'd have done the same thing if I'd been Pyongyang, looking at an untrustworthy agreement partner like the United States. The Congress undermined that agreement. So we need to be very careful, even if President Obama is able and the permanent 5+1, we always forget that. This is Germany, Russia, China, the other members of the permanent members of the UN Security Council. It's not just us doing this and Iran. If we do get an agreement, Congress still has the ability to undermine it.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. He currently teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Magnificent Seven. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the shooting of two police officers in Ferguson, Missouri. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Doug Moore, a diversity reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Doug Moore.
Hi, hello. How are you?
Well, thanks, Doug. Now, what's the latest in Ferguson? The Attorney General has said that the shooter of the two police officers early this morning is a damn punk trying to sow discord in an area that was trying to get its act together, trying to bring together a community that had been fractured for too long. What do we know about police activities surrounding a home and who these likely suspects might be?
Well, yeah, that was really strong language coming out of his office today. Right now, we know very little on this. We know that they were there was a strong police presence at a home not too far from the police department, and they did question and did arrest some people, but there were no charges there. We don't have anybody's name, so we don't really know who these folks were or who they are. We do know that the police are still, you know, there's a reward was put out for $10,000 today. It was announced, leading to the arrest and conviction of whoever the shooter is, to try to get some of these folks, because I think the feeling is that somebody probably knows who was involved and is just not willing to come forward yet. So and you may have seen that the state police and the county police are going to take over watch at the police department for protest moving forward, so that the city police officers can continue just their routine patrols throughout the city, because it's a little uncertain what's going to happen today and into the night.
Well, it seems so counterproductive. I mean, obviously, there's no excuse for this kind of violence, but you know, the idea was that the police chief had just resigned, had he not, at the time, before the shooting?
Yeah, he had. I think, I mean, this took us by surprise. I mean, it's actually quite shocking that there had not been any shootings of police officers up until this point. As you know from following this story, there were nightly protests and there were a lot of very heated confrontations between protesters and law enforcement, and there were gunshots throughout those protests, but no police officers had ever been injured. So for, you know, and one of the key demands that the protesters had been making through this process was they wanted the police chief, Tom Jackson, to resign and or to be fired. And so he had announced it earlier in the day, and that he was going to be out in by the 19th. And so we thought maybe there might be some, you know, people celebrating, but it got very heated late into the night, early in the morning, and then there were these shots, three or four shots we've heard from that were in the. Police chief of the county, St. Louis County, is saying that it looks like police were targeted, and there were like 25 police officers that were standing in a group when these shots were fired. So of course it sent people scrambling, including one of our own reporters and photographers that was there nearby. So it was a really dangerous situation, obviously, for everyone, including the protesters. There were, you know, they could have easily been hit as well.
And it just seems quite miraculous that the police weren't injured more. One was shot in the face and another in the shoulder. They've both been released from hospital. I take it that...
Yeah, that is pretty incredible because, you know, those kind of things, you know, it could be an inch or two either direction on a body, and that would have been, it could have been a fatal to either one of them. So in that regard, they're very fortunate, but it's still, you know, a very dangerous situation, and now no one really knows what to expect going forward.
So what impact do you think this will have on reforms? Clearly the Attorney General is furious, and his statements of calling these shooters damn punks, or shooter a damn punk, is because this is going to hurt a community trying to change. There have been some major changes, right? The city manager resigned last Tuesday. The judge who was giving out all of these tickets to create revenue for the city, he's been transferred. It seems like there are improvements underway.
Yeah, and we did have two police officers within the department and a court clerk that were also booted. The police officers retired and the clerk was fired, and that was as a result of the Justice Department investigation where they unearthed emails that had racist jokes and comments in those. So over the last week, we've had six people from the city of Ferguson either step down or be fired. And yeah, the city manager was a big one, and of course the police chief yesterday was next. And the protesters seemed to want Mayor Knowles as well to step down, but he has been steadfast in saying that he's not going to as late as yesterday. He said that someone has got to lead the reform, someone's got to run the city and work through the issues, and it would do no good for him to step down at this time. So that's sort of one of the last pieces that the protesters are holding out for. I think the reform will continue. I think there's too many people looking into the municipal court systems here because we have so many of them. Almost every little town has their own little system and their own little fiefdom for collecting money. And I think that's going to continue because legislators are involved now, and obviously the Attorney General's involved, the Justice Department's involved. There's a lot of pressure from above for these reforms to continue. Certainly the shooting last night was a tragedy and certainly a big distraction from those reforms, but it's not going to stop the efforts to change from happening.
And Doug Moore, again, the diversity reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Is there any evidence of or any knowledge of who these shooters are in terms of whether they're outside? It sounds like they're local people because you said the house, at least the one that appears to be related to the shooting, that's the police have had under siege, and they've arrested three people, I believe. So during the major protests back after Michael Brown was shot, there were some people from the outside joining in the demonstrations. But last night's protest in front of the police station, that was all a local action, I take it.
Yeah. As best we can tell, there's the usual crowd of protesters, the core protesters that go out to all of these events and live stream and participate in it. They're sort of the key organizers. The outside agitators, as they're oftentimes called, had sort of, you know, left Ferguson. And your initial question, I think, was, based on where police were searching, we believe that this shooter or shooters were local folks. I think they have their eye on one particular person that they thought was hiding in that house. So either the shooter was there, and these people may have been arrested because they knew information or were harboring, you know, him or something like that. I mean, a lot of it's assumption. We can't, you know, the police aren't telling us a whole lot at this point in time, but they are asking the public for help. And like I said, they're trying to entice folks to come forward with a $10,000 reward for information.
So what's your reading then on the mood? Is it, I mean, I think there's, judging from the Attorney General's remarks, there's a certain amount of shock and disgust at what happened. It seems like the last thing that we need at this point. And now there's, you know, instead of the cry for Black Lives Matter, now there's a cry, Blue Lives Matter.
Well, you know, it could change that. I mean, just this is sort of me talking here, is that it could shift the relationship between police and protesters. In that the protesters who are out there pushing for the reform and actually can, you know, take some of that credit, you might see them sort of being more sympathetic. They might see them working together to try to reach these goals, because they want to distance themselves from anyone who would try to harm or kill, you know, police officers. I don't know, but it would seem like that could be a strategy that would work and something that might help, because obviously those relationships have been tenuous at best. And with Jackson gone, you know, we'll have to kind of see who, you know, they've appointed an interim police chief within the department, and they're getting ready to launch a national search. So, you know, whoever that person is could also sort of change the dynamics of the relationship between protesters and the community and those at City Hall.
Well, of course, it doesn't help that former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani said that the police officer who shot Michael Brown should be commended. That was his response to this. So,
well, you know, it's unfortunate when folks that are unfamiliar with the case and have not followed it closely and speak like that, because it does, again, that does little good except, flame the fire and get people riled up, and I don't really know what he hopes to accomplish by saying that. The Justice Department did say that, I mean, there were two findings from them, as you know. One was looking at the shooting and to see if there should be any charges brought up against him for shooting Michael Brown, and they said that there should not be. So they cleared him essentially of any wrongdoing in that case, because they were able to determine there had been a conflict between Michael Brown and Darren Wilson in the car. There had been a struggle for the gun inside the patrol car, and that the testimony was inconsistent to determine that Michael Brown had his hands up when he was shot. But he might have had his hands up at one time, but that there was a movement toward the officer when he was shot. So does that mean you should bring Darren Wilson back to the department? Does that mean he should be lauded as a hero? I don't think that personally. And bringing someone back to the department like that, I mean, can you imagine what that would do to relations? I mean, clearly that would serve no good purpose in trying to heal what's a really deep wound right now.
Well, Doug Moore, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Doug Moore, who's a diversity reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the democratic awakening underway in Ferguson, Missouri.
Police are thieves in the street.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us is Todd Swanstrom, a professor of community collaboration and public policy at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, recently serving as a neighborhood planner for the city of Cleveland and as a staff director for strategic planning for the city of Albany. He has published articles on the prospects of alliances between central cities and distressed suburbs, economic segregation amongst municipalities, different ways of measuring poverty, and the development of a regional greenway in St. Louis. He's the co-author of Place Matters, Metropolitics for the 21st Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Todd Swanstrom.
Glad to be here, Ian.
And your city of St. Louis and the surrounding cities, one of which is Ferguson, have clearly have been roiling for some time. And now that in a demonstration last night in front of the Ferguson police station, two policemen were ambushed and shot. That, of course, doesn't help matters. So let's start with that. What's the local response?
Well, we just found out about it. In fact, it was not in the morning papers. It had occurred late enough. So I'm not sure what the response, well, but certainly when friends of mine and I was at a gathering this morning, and we are very disturbed. It's a tragic situation, and really, it just rubs further, you know, the raw wounds that exist on both sides in some ways, from the viewpoint of the police, obviously, and from the viewpoint of the community. So it just shows that we're just going to have to dig deeper and do more work to deal with these issues. And, of course, our heartfelt condolences go out to the families of the police officers who were shot.
And, of course, the police chief of Ferguson, Thomas Jackson, who was excoriated in the recent Department of Justice report, his resignation was announced, I believe, last night. I'm wondering whether people knew that he was stepping down at the time or after the shooting took place. I mean, it seems, obviously, there's no justification for it, but it also seems if you're angry, you know, I can understand the anger being expressed earlier, and it was certainly justified. But now that actually something is being done, it seems a peculiar action.
Well, you know, Ian, yeah, I think that you're right. I mean, this is a further evidence that that the demonstrations really hit their mark. I mean, there's action being taken. I think the feeling is, at least from the viewpoint of the mayor of Ferguson, not so much that Chief Jackson was guilty or, you know, had to step down because he had violated this or that law, but rather that in order to move forward, we need new leadership, and I think that's the right perspective. If you remember when you had riots in Los Angeles many years ago, the need to get a new chief of police in Los Angeles was a big issue for quite a while, and your chief was quite entrenched, and I think that in some ways slowed down the process of moving forward. So here in St. Louis, I think that was really a step forward. Not commenting on exactly whether his leadership. I think he clearly made errors, but it's important that we move forward. But you know, Ian, what's going on here is you have legitimate protests, which are part of a long-standing American tradition of democracy, that you can have free speech. You have the right, as the Constitution reads, to petition your government for a redress of grievances. That's the exact words from the U.S. Constitution. So this is a civil right we have to protest and to get your issues heard. But when people take advantage of it to shoot police officers or to torch businesses, often owned by local African-American entrepreneurs, then they are exploiting the situation. They're not part of the solution. So we have what's disappointing is that from the outside world, I think they sometimes conflate those two, that, you know, that the burning of the businesses was kind of irresponsible action on the part of the protesters, but it wasn't with the protesters. As far as I know, last night the protests were largely peaceful. This occurred, you know, at the end of the protests. And so I want to make it clear that those who are trying to address these grievances are not the ones who are torching the businesses and shooting policemen.
And again, I'm speaking with Todd Swanstrom, who is a professor of community collaboration and public policy at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He was previously a neighborhood planner for the city of Cleveland and staff director for strategic planning for the city of Albany. And his latest book is Place Matters, Metropolitics for the 21st Century. So let's talk about this phenomenon of the city of St. Louis being surrounded by smaller cities, one of which is Ferguson. Now, the city manager, John Shaw, he was forced to step down on Tuesday. He also, along with the chief of police, came in for severe criticism in the Department of Justice review of the shooting of Michael Brown. And also the local judge, who was responsible for essentially issuing blizzards of speeding and tickets, etc., in order to finance the city, he stepped down, but he had multiple roles in various other neighboring cities, either as a prosecutor or as a judge, which in itself is rather strange. So how come you have this phenomenon of all these little, are they sort of bedroom communities, or what's the explanation for this overlap of sort of moonlighting officials?
Yeah, so we in St. Louis are on the far end of municipal fragmentation. We are viewed as one of the three most fragmented metropolitan areas in the United States. There are other areas like Pittsburgh and Chicago and many other metropolitan areas that have fragmented local suburban governments. Many of them were created in the middle to later 20th century after World War II. Many cases, they were enclaves. Ironically enough, many of them were designed to zone out low-income and minority households. They were created almost as enclaves to protect really working-class and middle-class households that had moved from the central city. And so you have these small municipalities, and what's happened in recent years, what's happening, Ian, is that poverty is suburbanizing. Poor people are moving out of the central city. The central cities are often doing better today than many of these suburbs. So they're moving to these suburbs where you have relatively inexpensive housing. You have housing that was built when there was a huge shortage of housing after World War II, so they put off a lot of houses quickly, all of the same type. Maybe they're about half the size of the typical new home that's being built today, less than half the size. And so in the contemporary period, they're becoming the new form of affordable housing for low-income people. These are what look like, small suburban homes. And so what you have is these municipalities that are financially distressed. They don't have the tax base to support the services. And by being very small, they lack the professionalism, they lack the economies of scale that come from having a certain size government where you can have well-trained police officers with proper equipment. So what's happened is these municipalities have fallen into this game that if they really aren't in a position to raise taxes, if they raise taxes, that will just drive property values down further. So what they do is they turn to traffic fines and court fees. And then what happens is the way these are imposed is they're imposed on the weakest members of our society because those are the ones who can't fight back. If you can afford a lawyer, and by the way, I've gotten several of these tickets, I just sent it to my lawyer, and my lawyer plea bargains it down to a non-moving violation. I pay extra fees, and then the whole thing is off my desk. So if you're a middle-class person like myself, you can deal with this by hiring a lawyer. But if you're poor, you often get caught in a whole, what sometimes has been termed as a debtor's prison, where you are convicted, and you don't have the money to pay the fine immediately, and then you get a warrant for your arrest, and then the fines start to mount up, and pretty soon you owe $500, $800, $1,000, $1,500 in fines, and they put you in prison. And obviously, if you're put in jail, you can't keep your job, and you may lose your license. So it's a whole kind of merry-go-round of exploitation and really mistreatment of African Americans and low-income households in these small municipalities. But I want to say right away, Ian, that this is not unique to St. Louis. This is happening around the country. St. Louis is simply an extreme version of this fragmented municipal system.
Well, but what explains how racist in many ways these communities are? and much of the bedroom communities are apparently a result of white flight. You know, we've just had this anniversary of the Selma March, and I did reports on Selma from Selma, and everybody's saying, you know, things have changed down there for the better, but it doesn't seem like in the north there's still residues of racism. I mean, one of the people that was fired, there have been five officials fired as a result of this DOJ report. One of them was Marianne Twitty, who was the city clerk, who basically, you know, got all of her friends who got tickets, got them off, and was one of the people that exploited this system of indenture and what you would refer to as debtor's prison. She was she was caught, you know, the New York Times found all these incredibly racist emails from her. So what explains the racism in the North when we are so used to the idea that this is something associated with the South?
It's a good question, Ian, and I'm going to push back a little on your frame, because I think the media has treated this solely through a race frame, and the interpretation has been that nothing has changed since the civil rights movements of the 60s, that we're as racist as ever. And that's not at all, I think, the reality on the ground. That there is certainly racism, and, you know, unfortunately that sort of seems like it's deeply embedded in the human condition, including subconscious and subliminal racism, which we're probably all guilty of in some way or another, in groups and out groups. So I don't want to deny that race isn't an important factor here. It is. But it's the intersection of race and class that is really the toxic brew today. And what happens in a place like Ferguson is you've concentrated all of the low-income housing in a few developments on the east side of Ferguson. So you have poverty rates there of 30% and 40% and higher. And that area, by the way, you know, where Michael Brown was shot, it's a dead end street. There's no parks for kids to play in, and often there's no sidewalks. So it's really, you know, not a good environment. It's not good planning. But to say that it was simply, you know, that this is being driven by racists, you know, like Bull Connor in the 60s, is, I think, to miss, you know, the underlying dynamics. And what the underlying dynamics are is that, you know, earlier in the 20th century, African Americans in St. Louis were forbidden by law in some cases, or explicitly by the real estate industry, to buy homes in more advantaged parts of the region. So they were stuck to live in communities with less opportunity and with less ability to acquire assets by having a home that goes up in value. So they were stuck in the least favored quarter of the region. And as a result, today they don't have, African Americans who are most white, don't have the resources, the economic resources, to buy into the better communities. So they end up living in these small suburbs with inexpensive housing, which your listeners in Los Angeles might be interested to hear, that homes in Ferguson, at least in parts of Ferguson, or in some of these other municipalities, sell for as little as a two-bedroom home would sell for as little as $50,000 or $60,000. So that's what they can afford. So there's this history behind this. But is overt discrimination the cause of the problems? It's certainly exacerbating it in the case of the employee you mentioned in Ferguson, who obviously you know, has racial fears and racial prejudices. But with the deep underlying pressures that are creating this very combustible mix in a place like Ferguson is the intersection of race and class, and people don't have any opportunity to get ahead. They're stuck in communities without appreciating homes and without job opportunities and without, you know, good local public services. So the white people who live in Ferguson, who I think are often portrayed as racist, they're living in a diverse community, actually. And so many of them are my friends, are working to make that community work. And it's not white versus black. You have whole suburbs here that, in some sense, are being exploited by a regional political economy that has left them out in the cold.
Well, just though, according to the Justice Department report on Ferguson and the racial bias in Ferguson, the Justice Department report found that 93% of people arrested in Ferguson are African Americans, whereas only 67% of Ferguson's population is black. 96% of people arrested for outstanding municipal warrants are African Americans. 95% of, this is apparently an infraction, manner of walking in roadway. 95% of manner and walking roadway charges were against black people. 90% of documented force was against African Americans. And conversely, 30% of searches of white suspects resulted in a contraband finding compared with 24% for black suspects. So that...
Yeah, there's no doubt. Yeah, there's no doubt. You know what's going on here? There's two things. There's three things. One is race. And that's certainly a factor here, that people are engaging in stereotypical thinking. The police, the cops, who are engaging in prejudice, right? They're thinking that it's easier for them to stop a black person. It's more likely they'll have an arrest warrant. It's more likely they're not going to push back. Part of it is simply economics, because people who are poor often aren't able to fix the taillight that's broken, often aren't able to keep up their insurance, often aren't able to deal with these small infractions, so they're exploited for that reason. And thirdly, they lack political power. So what's going on here is that the powerless people are being exploited. Believe me, if this were happening, you know, if a wealthy person is stopped for a taillight, many times they will push back in these more well-to-do suburbs and others and say, you know, stop hassling me with these minor violations. The African-American community in Ferguson had, as you know, only one council member was black. There were only, I think, something like 3 out of the 53 members of the police force were African-American. So they didn't have the power and the incorporate, they didn't have the ability to push back against this oppressive behavior. And you get a population, in the last municipal election, the African-American turnout was about 7%. And so they weren't turning out to vote. Now, it doesn't mean that this is not the situation before the Civil Rights Movement, where people were not allowed to vote. This is that people did not register to vote. And believe me, as far as I can tell, they're going to start registering to vote, and they're going to win election, and they're going to take over the Ferguson government. There is no doubt about, in my mind, that African-Americans will become leaders of the city of Ferguson in the years ahead. It might not happen in the next election, but it'll happen soon afterward. And then they'll be in charge of a government, once again, whose tax base is inadequate to provide the services that are needed by the local population. And by the way, there is one municipality which is governed by a black mayor and an all-black city council that engaged in the same oppressive practices, and whose police department was majority black. And they engaged in the same practices. Not, once again, not to excuse the racism, but to stress that there are a combination of factors at work, and we can't isolate one.
Well, just in closing, Todd Swanstrom, in the terms of the work that you do with alliances between central cities and distressed suburbs, economic segregation amongst municipalities, and different ways of measuring poverty, and the development of a regional greenway in St. Louis, are there anything in terms of what you're trying to do in terms of city planning, et cetera, that can help solve these problems, which, as you pointed out, are in the process of being solved by simple voter participation?
Sure. I mean, the voter participation is the first step in registering to vote. And community organizing is extremely important. People need to acquire voice, because really what happened in Ferguson is the failure of representative democracy. It failed, and therefore they had to go to the streets to be heard. I think they're finally being heard. Actions are being taken. People are being removed from office. The Missouri Court of Appeals has taken over the municipal court. It's going to restructure it. But really, if you're talking about the underlying factors here, one, I can talk about many things in the area of community economic development that's needed. But one thing that we talked about this morning at a forum is if we brought a light rail system out to Ferguson, what happens in these suburbs is that they lack the kind of public transit that can give people access to jobs and opportunity. So if we could bring, and we're talking about this in St. Louis, expanding our light rail system up into Ferguson, out through Ferguson, out to the community college, something like that could spur investment and spur development, so these communities would not be isolated from opportunity, but would be connected to the region. It will require a lot of work to do that, but we're starting to do that in other suburbs in St. Louis. That will, that kind of investment is what could stimulate development. And you know, what we need to do is stop putting all the subsidized housing in one place and start creating mixed-income communities that are viable. And this means that that the privileged suburbs in the region need to step up to the plate, the ones that are often, by the way, lily white and uniformly upper middle class or affluent. That's where the jobs often are, but they have zoned their municipality in such a way that you can build zero multifamily housing. So they need to, we need to open up suburbs to so that low-income and minority families can gain access to the opportunities throughout the region, and then we need to develop communities like Ferguson so we bring opportunity and jobs to them. So there's a lot of work to be done, but you know, once again, yeah, this isn't just St. Louis. This is happening all across the country.
Well, Todd Swanstrom, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Todd Swanstrom, who is a professor in community collaboration and public policy at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Recently, he served as a neighborhood planner for the city of Cleveland and as a staff director of strategic planning for the city of Albany. He's worked for alliances between central cities and distressed suburbs, economic segregation amongst municipalities, different ways of measuring poverty, and the development of a regional greenway in St. Louis. And he's the co-author of Place Matters, Metropolitics for the 21st Century. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Down.